to another episode of the Conversations with Authors podcast. I'm your host, Alison Thompson, aka the Proof Fairy. In each episode of this podcast, I talk to an author about what inspired them to start writing and what tips they would give other aspiring authors. Today is Mitali Depakesa. Mitali has had a long career as a journalist and copywriter, and now she specialises in teaching business owners how to write books that build expert authority. I really enjoyed chatting with Mitali, as did my dogs, it seems, so apologies for their occasional interruptions. Hello, Mitali, it's really lovely to meet you today. Tell me a bit about your book.
Thank you for having me, Alison. Okay, so my book, it's called The Freedom Master Plan. Mm-hmm. And it's on the surface, what it's addressing is a question that I keep getting asked all the time. And it drives me crazy, you know, and it's always, is it worth me writing a book? I'm talking about entrepreneurs, coaches, consultants, speakers, and it just wanted to answer that. But it wanted to answer that in a way that wasn't just, yes, you should just write a book, but actually giving, you know, which is sort of like, well, yes, you're going to say that. You're a book coach, a book publisher. So it's like asking a web designer, is it worth me having a website? What do you think they're going to say to you?
I don't think you should bother with that. Yeah,
exactly. So I thought, rather than just write a book about this is why you should write a book, I thought, what I'm going to do is interview a number of my previous clients who either wrote a book with me or I wrote a book for them as a ghostwriter.
Okay.
And what they did with their book. So it's very case study based, and it's all about all the different strategies and tactics they used to leverage their books to build their business.
Right.
I think that's the key thing, because I do have a lot of people who think that, you know, they can just write a book, stick it on Amazon, and then the world will stop turning because they're now a published author. And I just have to have news for them and say, you do realize on an average day, over 3,000 books are uploaded to Amazon worldwide.
Wow, as many as that. Gosh, yeah. I know it's a lot.
Exactly. So you stay, no matter how good it is as well, it could be the best content the world has ever seen. But you just stick a book up on Amazon and do nothing with it, the world's not going to stop turning and you're not going to get what you wanted to get out of being a published author. Yeah. So what my book does is it's for two groups of people. So people who are already published authors, but never understood what to do with a business book. So they wrote a book or a how-to book and they put it on Amazon, but no one explained to them, yes, now you need to leverage your book. So what my book will do is give all these tips and strategies. You can kind of cherry pick the ones that fit you, feel right to you, the ones that will fit your business model, and just implement them. And the other group of people, it's for those people who are sat there wanting to write a business book, but they're wondering whether it's worth it. And I want them to see the end game. So that's what my book is all about. It's all about, if you can see the end game, if you can see, oh yeah, this person's like me and they've got a business that's similar to mine and they did this with their book, then I can do that as well. So I think that's really important, because there's a lot of people out there who are, you know, book coaches teaching people to write books, and maybe they're not being completely honest. You know, the thing is, the book business is a tough business. And if you're, I always say, if the book itself is your moneymaker, that is one tough business you're getting into. That is, you have to sell millions, you know, if not, I would say at the most hundreds of thousands of units to make enough money to have a comfortable living. Yeah. But if you don't see the book as your money spinner, but instead you see it as the key to opening up the treasures. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm doing with my book. I mean, I haven't even logged in to my Amazon account to see how much money I've made, despite the fact they became a bestseller in four different countries. So I think I made a few hundred quid,
but well done.
I haven't even bothered logging in, because I'm not really bothered about how much money I make from the book. It's what the book is doing for me. It's getting me such immense visibility that I would never have had without the book.
Yeah.
It's getting people towards me. It's getting people like you who want to bring me on to your podcast, you know? So it opens up this flood of visibility and people knowing what you're all about, knowing your message and gravitating towards you. And yeah, that's where the money is. It's the increased visibility. It's the new clients, the clients who want to spend more money on you. That's where the money is, not the actual sales of the books. Yeah. So I wanted a book that explained that and showed people how they can do that by following these case studies from my previous clients.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it? It's something that I tell people as well. I always say to them, why do you want to write this book? Why do you want to publish this book? If they say to make some money, I'd say, well, don't bother, because you're probably not even going to cover your costs of having it proofread and published. Publish it because, yes, like you said, with business books, because it's going to be your business card. It's going to be leverage into other opportunities. Or if it's a memoir or if it's fiction, publish it because you want to share your story, because you want to say you're an author, but don't do it for money. Have some other reason to publish. Absolutely. Yeah. So where do you get your inspiration for writing?
Oh, gosh. How long have you got, Alison?
Time.
I don't think your listeners are going to want to be with us for the next 6 hours, you know.
Oh, okay, maybe not.
Let me try and make a short version. So I think it comes from this is a story that my mother tells me. I was too young to remember. So my very first day of nursery, I was one of those precocious children, didn't even look back at my mother. You know, you get those really teary, clingy kids. That was not me. I just didn't even look at it. I just ran off into a sea of kids. I just
left your mother in tears.
Yes, I think my mother was probably crying. I didn't care. I really didn't care. I was just like, oh my God, these new little human beings for me to speak with. So off I went, and my mother tells me this story because I don't remember. I was 4 years old. Mm. But I'm the oldest of four children in an Indian Bengali household. Mm. And because I'm the first, my parents spoke Bengali to each other and they spoke Bengali to me. So at the age of four, I didn't know any English. I spoke Bengali. But wow, more importantly, I had no concept that I was in a country where the language that I spoke wasn't the main language, that there was this huge other language that everyone else spoke. Yeah. So off I went to nursery speaking very loud Bengali to all these kids. It must have been thought I was the strangest thing to have ever. I mean, bearing in mind, this is early 1980s UK in Newcastle, which wasn't anywhere near as multicultural as places like Bradford, London, Birmingham, Leicester. So I was pretty much the only brown kid there anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm already sticking like a sore thumb, and then I'm speaking this strange language that the other kids don't understand, which must have been interesting. I don't remember any of this. But my mother tells me that what I did was I ran off to the corner library. If you remember back then, nurses used to have a corner where there was a library.
Book corner.
Exactly. The reading corner, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I ran off there, and I must have instinctively realized that I needed to read these books to learn English. And then my mother tells me that, you know, for the next year or so, every single time she'd drop me off to nursery, I'd just run off straight away to the corner. And then when she'd come and pick me up a few hours later, I was still in that corner reading books. So that's where I developed a voracious appetite for reading books from the age of four. And I assume it was because I wanted to be able to communicate. Yeah. It's something we take for granted, being able to communicate. But I don't remember any of this, but I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah. Gosh, so when did you start writing then? Or writing for
I think it was a natural progression from that, you know, because you're reading so much, you tend to, you know, your vocabulary gets better, then you start thinking, hey, I could do this. So I would say from the age of 6 or 7, I was always, you know, that annoying nerd at school that always got A at English literature, and, you know, and all the cool kids didn't like, you know. I even used to get excited about doing sort of essays on books. If you told me to do, you know, do an essay on The Mayor of Casterbridge by Hardy, I'd be like, oh my God, this is so amazing. So no wonder the cool kids didn't like me. They were looking forward to going ice skating on a Friday night. I was looking forward to writing an essay on The Mayor of Casterbridge. So,
great fun of parties, I bet.
Exactly. So I just enjoyed writing, and that, yeah, and I never really saw it as a career option, though, because, you know, typical Asian parents, they wanted me to be, you know, a doctor. I know it's a stereotype, but it exists for a reason. So yeah. I was all gung-ho on studying medicine at university and becoming a doctor, and the writing thing really was just something I enjoyed doing. But because I was doing so much of it and the teachers at my school could see that I really enjoyed it, one of my teachers, she without telling me, she entered me into a competition. It was for, it was for a summer school, a month-long summer school in Edinburgh. And I, you know, I won. There's me and I think maybe 20 to 25 other kids around the country who got this opportunity. Wow. And in one of the workshops, it was me and five other children. And we co-wrote an episode of Brookside. So that's
cool.
That was so amazing. I didn't even watch Brooks at the time. My mother didn't allow me, said it was adult content and I shouldn't watch it. Looking back at some of the things that were being shown on Brookside, she probably had a point, really. But yeah, I co-wrote an episode of Brookside, and that's when something ignited in me. Because I think before that, I was writing, but it was mainly for my pleasure or it was schoolwork. It was one or the other.
Yeah.
Whereas now I'd written something that was going to go out on TV. And yes, it was, you know, there was five other children on it. And of course, we had the grown-ups, you know, monitoring what we're doing and that kind of thing. So it wasn't just me that went off and wrote an episode. I'm not that amazing. But, you know, it was still something to see. And then to see it on TV, it was like, oh, wow, this can be a career option. You know, writing in itself isn't just for pleasure. It could actually be something that I do. So that's where it started. That's how I started getting into writing.
So, you said writing can be a career option. So just tell me a little bit about how you've got to where you are now.
So after that, that was it. You know, I think seeing my work on a screen, it just kind of made me realize I really don't want to do medicine. It kind of just spoiled it for me. Right. So I changed my subjects. And then I ended up doing a media studies degree in Manchester University. And then after that, a natural progression was to do my master's at London School of Journalism. And I became a freelance journalist for a number of years in my 20s. Oh. I was working for a number of local magazines and newspapers in the northwest of England, one of them being the Manchester Evening News. And yeah, that's where it started. So I was really enjoying my life then. I was in my 20s, so I was one of those roving entertainment reporters, which basically involved getting free meals and free drinks at clubs. So as you can imagine, a young woman in her 20s, I thought I'd just, you know, landed in heaven, really. It's not really my idea of heaven now. I can't imagine staying up till 3 a.m. trying to review a nightclub and then coming home and not going to bed straight away, but actually wanting to hit a deadline. So I'd be typing away at 5 a.m, you know, because I need to hit a deadline. But at the time, you know, I had the energy of a very young woman and it was a fantastic lifestyle.
Dream job, I guess. Yeah.
It was. It really was. Because I really liked being sociable and being out and at clubs and parties and restaurants and that kind of thing. So it was fantastic. And then like everything, it always comes to an end. It never stays like that, does it? Yeah. So this was around 2001. And this was, if you remember back then, this was when there was this thing called new media, which we now know as the internet. And I think all editors just panicked. They just kind of thought that no one's going to want to read newspapers and magazines anymore. And, you know, everyone's going to go on to this newfangled thing. I remember telling them at the time that they were being incredibly short-sighted because people still need news. All that was happening was the medium was changing. But people still need content. But a lot of editors didn't see it that way. So there was just mass redundancies of all journalists and reporters up and down the country. And as a freelance one, I was one of the first to go because you let the freelance ones go first, obviously. Who are on a salary.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that kind of, you know, really affected me. My mental health really went down the toilet at that point. It's quite hard at the age of 25, 26, thinking your career's over, you know? That's a very young age to just go, okay, so that's my career done and dusted. It's a bit different, I think, if that happens in your 50s, but when you're just in your mid-20s, and I just couldn't figure out what to do.
Yeah. So that, and like you said, it wasn't just the job ending. It was the whole industry that you were, that you trained for, that you were working.
Yes.
The whole industry changing. So I guess, yeah, it's more than just losing a job. It's kind of everything changing. Yeah.
Everything. It wasn't, I couldn't even go and look for another job. You know, it's not like, oh, well, this newspaper no longer needs me. I'll go and apply to this other newspaper.
Yeah.
It was happening across the board.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was the end of, I honestly thought it was the end of a career, you know.
Yeah. So where did you go after that?
Well, I kind of spent nearly 10 years in the wilderness where I was just doing whatever jobs I needed to do to make ends meet. You know, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, unfortunately. So I had to do, so I did recruitment. I did a little bit of banking. I did all kinds of things. You know, I could spend hours talking about all the strange little jobs I did here and there. Which I now look back and I think, actually, you know, they built my personality. So, but at the time I wasn't very happy. It was just something I needed to do.
Yeah.
And then I even decided to finally study medicine. I lost my dad in 2007. Maybe there was an element of guilt there. And I felt like I never kind of fulfilled what he wanted me to do. And now that I was no longer being able to do what I wanted to do, it just kind of made sense in my head. I thought, well, if I can't fulfill my dreams, at least I can fulfill my dad's dreams. So I put myself to university again. This is in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a psychology degree and I started working in psychiatric wards. And I even did a spell in prison, not as a prisoner, obviously, but on the other side of it.
Yeah.
I wanted to train as a psychologist for the NHS, a clinical psychologist. So that was on the cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess deep down, I always knew I wanted to get back into writing. I was just maybe not consciously, but subconsciously just trying to find a way, like, what do I do? How do I get into this?
Yeah.
And then the answer came in the unlikeliest of places. A good friend of mine. So I, at this stage, I'd moved back to the northeast of England. My dad had died and my mother had asked me to go and live with her. And a friend from Manchester University, he contacted me and he has a big SEO firm where he helps businesses build their search engine optimization rankings. And he just rang me one day out of the blue, just say, hey, have you heard about this Google algorithm update? I just thought, I can barely say algorithm. Why on earth would I care about some sort of, you know, why? I mean, you have an SEO business, so it's your job to stay on top of things like that. Why on earth would I be keeping on top of Google updates? And he said, no, this is really important. This new update means that they're no longer just looking at keywords. They're looking at how long people spend on a blog post, on a website.
Yeah.
They're analyzing how useful this is, which means a lot of website owners who've relied on cheap labor, you know, from Southeast Asia or Eastern Europe to write their articles, they can no longer do that. They actually now need native writers who are engaging and who know how to keep people on their site.
Mm.
So you just, I needed to tell you, because I think this could be your way back into writing.
Right. And as a paid content writer.
Pretty much. That's how I started. I started my first business in 2014, part-time. I was still working in psychiatric wards at the same time because I couldn't afford not to. And I started just, anybody who put, this is Gumtree. This is back in the days when Gumtree was huge. Do you remember Gumtree?
Gosh,
does anyone still use that?
Only fraudsters, I think.
I was like, that was huge back then. So I would go into Gumtree daily and people would put adverts on there. Hey, I'm needing somebody to write me articles on this subject or that subject. And I would just apply to as many as I can.
Yeah.
You know, and I just wrote content, but, you know, I've done some strange things. I remember writing an 80-page ebook on mattresses. So I'll see if you ever need to know about anything there is to know about mattresses.
Wow. I'm amazed you found enough to fill 80 pages. That's
80 pages worth. Eight, all the different kinds of coils, the different kinds of memory, everything. So
wow.
I did that. I there was one client, a fantastic client of mine, based in Arkansas in the state. And he had a gun store. So I spent most of my time writing about holsters and which guns are best for women and which are best for men and how to shoot in the dark. I've never handled a gun in my whole life, by the way. I don't want to. So it was a very interesting time. I was learning. So that's a wonderful thing about being a writer for hire.
I did a little spell of that myself. I did a bit of blog writing for people. So yeah, I wrote a lot of articles about a specific garage storage system. I worked for a long time for a technology company who made kind of the forerunner to smart boards and all that kind of technology.
Yes.
So I had no idea what I was writing, but I wrote stuff. I can remember one day researching for another post I was writing for them and reading an article and thinking, oh, this one's useful, and then reading it, realizing it was one I'd written for them.
Just thinking, no, I can't really research my own article, really.
It does mean you get to learn some really, really interesting.
I've learned some. I mean, there's one that one month, I remember, this is in 2015. So the month of August, the whole of that month, I was hired by a lovely gentleman in the south of England who is a Love Honey affiliate. Now, you know what Love Honey is?
No.
It's an adult store.
Okay.
I spent a whole month writing about adult products and how to use them. I remember thinking, oh my gosh.
snap. One of my contracts once was to write for an adult dating site. So yeah.
Yes. You learn so much. It's incredible how much you learn. In subjects that you wouldn't have thought of, because otherwise if someone told you about them, you wouldn't have researched that subject.
So presumably you then got into the whole book coaching that kind of followed through.
What happened was, from the content writing, I moved into copywriting, mainly because I started to see, I started to hear this word copywriting a lot. And I thought, well, what is copywriting? I didn't really understand what was the difference between content writing and copywriting. And I knew there had to be a huge difference because copywriters were being they're paid at least 10 times more than the average content writer.
Yeah.
So it was really more from the money point of view I got into copywriting, because I just thought, if I can spend the same amount of time that I spend writing content, but make 10 times as much money, then I'm being more efficient. So that's how I got into copywriting and understanding that. And then from that, the books became a natural progression, because as a copywriter, you become very attuned to writing what makes money for your clients. I think with content writing, it's more indirect. I mean, it's all there. All content, if you think about it, is there to raise awareness, raise visibility, with the end goal being higher profits. That's why you're hired to
more
do
sales.
It.
Yeah.
But it's more indirect. Whereas with copywriting, it's very, very direct. You know, if you write a landing page and it doesn't convert, people don't subscribe, or you write a sales page and people aren't hitting the buy button and they're not, you know, parting with their cash, then you failed that client, basically. So it's a much tougher job, and I think that's why it pays better than content writing.
Yeah.
But that kind of made me, because I started to write all these different kinds of products and you know, for my clients, and the one thing I realized that made the biggest difference was a book. It was one of my clients who took a chance on me, a copywriting client, and he said, hey, I'd like to hire you to write my book, a business book. It's going to be a how-to business book. And I was scared because I'd never written
big
a book
project.
Before.
Yeah,
that's a huge, that was the biggest, the biggest project I had in my life so far. And I just thought, wow, I've never written a book. But he took a chance on me. And then I saw what that book did for him. And that's something just clicked in my head. And I thought, wow. I was thinking the biggest money spinner in terms of writing content, I always assumed would be the sales page. Because it's a sales page. It does what it says on the tin. The whole point of it is to make you sales. So up until that point, I would have thought the piece of copy that makes the biggest difference in an entrepreneur's life would be a sales page. But it wasn't. After that book and seeing what he did with the book, and he started touring parts of America with this book. He's based in the States. He started touring with this book, and the visibility he got and the number of clients started gravitating towards him.
Yeah.
And I realized, wow, this book has made more money than any sales page I ever wrote for him. Not from, I like going back to what we spoke about in the beginning, not from the book units, not from selling the book itself. In fact, most of the times he was giving the book away at events he went to. you know, or he was doing something where it was literally at cost. So he's just covering his costs for printing the book and that's it.
So I guess he was at those events because he'd written the book. That's where the doors were opening because he'd written the book. Yeah.
That's it. I don't think he would have been asked to speak at those events. And it's happened to me recently, just literally last week. I was, you know, we're both in a similar networking group that we do. And the founder, Brad, was there at one of my, I was giving a speech. I was doing the Foresight, they're called there, and I was doing that. And he recruited me to speak at the TBNS that's happening in September. So the business networking show. And he's asked me to speak on stage. And again, I don't think that would have happened if I didn't gain the original visibility from becoming a published author.
So
it's incredible.
So your book and presumably the way you work with your clients as well, I'm going to ask you to give away some of your secrets now. What's the writing process for you? How do you actually go about the physical process of planning it and getting it written?
I would say, first of all, the first thing they need to do is they need to research the market. I'm always amazed how many people write these books in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And it's like you can possibly do that if you're writing fiction, because that really is a more personal thing. Yeah. So, you know, if you're wanting to write, for example, say you want to write a historical fiction novel, do you now really need to go and read a ton of historical fiction? Not really, although it's still a good idea to see what's popular and what's working. But potentially, if you've got a great idea, you can just hole away somewhere and get that book done. But when you're writing a how-to book or a business book, you really need to know what's already out there, you know? So the first thing is, I would say, go and pick 3 to 5 books in your subject, in your niche, and give them a read. It's also a good idea to look at the reviews that people have left, because I find them very, very telling. You can tell from the reviews, you know, what's really going on with the book. And I will say, if you see a lot of negatives, that's what you need to avoid in your book. So there's so much you can learn before you even write a single word. Yeah. So that's one thing that my students always do, is they do research first. The second thing is meticulous planning. That's one of the, a huge thing. I think I was actually listening to one of your previous podcasts. I forget the name of the lady, but she writes romance novels, but with a sci-fi or a spiritual bent to it, which made me go, oh gosh, I need to pick up some of her books.
Yeah, what Lindsay I do Woodward, have that was Lindsay
that's
Woodward.
It yes yeah. And she was saying that she also does the planning, but she also said that a lot of her ideas come to her from her dreams, and then sometimes she'll sit on something for years and it will develop slowly.
Yeah,
that's wonderful when you're writing fiction. It does not work when you're writing these business books.
It's a different process, isn't it? Yeah, to
completely
write
different
fiction. Yeah, a factual book.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would say you need to plan everything out. I get my students to mind map their book out. So we use a free tool called mind42.com.
Yeah.
It's completely free. Anybody can use it. It's an online tool, and you can create the most detailed mind maps where you can literally put in every single thought that's gone into the book. And it means you can come back to it and add more thoughts as and when they pop up into your brain.
Yeah.
So that's something that I get my students to do before they write a single word. Mm-hmm. I also think of it as like the analogy I give them is you want to create a sat nav for your book.
Yeah.
Because I've seen so many business authors become tortured authors because they kind of started writing without really planning it all out. They hadn't a gist of what the book's going to be about. They had a rough idea of what's going to go into each chapter, and off they went to write it. But then as they're writing it, other ideas pop into the head. Now they're going to try and weave those ideas in with previous ideas. I met this one lady, bless her, I felt so bad. She'd been writing a book for 3 years. And because she hadn't planned properly, that's why it took 3 years. And now she was no longer the person she was 3 years ago. So she's now reading what she wrote in the first year, and she's had to bin most of it because it doesn't fit in. So I just thought, well, that's a year's worth of work you've just lost.
Yeah.
So
I was in a situation. I edited a book by someone who'd started it 5 years before, and they'd written quite a lot of the book. And then they sort of put it on the back burner, and then they come back to it, and they'd not really read over. They kind of quickly glanced over the start of it and written the rest of it. And their writer's voice had changed so much between that 5 years ago and now. And yeah, there were a lot of contradictions in opinions and things as well. So yeah, that's not a way to write a book.
It's definitely not a way to write a book. It's definitely, I think with fiction, there may be, I've never written fiction, so I couldn't say. Maybe there is an argument for sitting on things and letting, you know, characters come to life. And I have heard of, you know, I do have a number of friends who are fiction authors, and they do tell me that the character almost is independent of them and it reveals themselves. So I can see with a fiction book why, you know, spending 5 years writing a book would make it amazing.
Yeah,
it just doesn't happen with how-to or business books, you know. In fact, I would say it makes it worse. I always use the analogy that, you know, business books or how-to books are like, they're like steak, you know. They don't actually get tastier the more you cook them. In fact, they turn into leather. Right. So that's the same thing with these books. You need to plan meticulously first, know what it is that you want to say, what expertise you're going to share with the world. Also have an idea of what you want the book to do for you, which is kind of where my book comes in. You know, if you read my book, you get an understanding of what you want to do with your book after it's published. One of my first questions that I ask all my students when they start with me is, I want you to forget about writing a book. I want you to forget about planning a book. I want you to imagine it's several months from now and the book is already out there. You're already a published author. Mm-hmm. What are you doing with your book?
Right.
And I get them to describe to me, what are they talking on stages? Have they got some sort of book funnel and they're using Google Ads to you know, drive traffic to it? Are they doing tons of social media? What is it that they're doing? And then we work our way backwards from that. And when you do it that way, you find the book starts writing itself because you start to assemble things in the book that will fulfill that dream that you have of what you want the book to do for you. And then I say, once you've done that, get the book done as fast as possible, you know, as fast as possible. I always say dictate your book instead of writing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I use otter.ai. I'm not saying that's the only great app. I've been told there's quite a few other great apps, but it's the one that I've been using for years. And, you know, I have no reason to change because it does such a good job. But what I do and what my students do is once they've got their mind map, they just take a section of the mind map and they dictate into the app.
Yeah.
And then that way they speak a lot faster than they can type. But also another thing, these books need to be quite conversational in tone. There's nothing, and I've seen people do that when they type. I bet you've seen this as a proofreader.
I've talked about this a lot with authors as well, that you start writing and you go into this kind of weird formal stuff.
Yeah, it's almost it's like they have a personality transplant. Yeah. It's like there's the person that you know who you go to a coffee shop with and you can have a chat with, and then this author, and you're just thinking, but you don't speak like that in real life, which might be fine. Like I said, if you're in fiction, you may even write under an alias, which is absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But these business books are there to elevate you and boost you, make you appear as an authority and a future thought leader even. It needs to sound like you.
Yes.
And one of the biggest compliments that people have given me about my book has been like, I can hear your voice in my head. When I'm reading your book, I can hear your voice in my head. And that's the biggest compliment you can give me, because that's what these books should be about. They should sound like the author, as if they've just taken you to the coffee shop.
They're
just chatting to you about their expertise and how they can help you.
Yeah.
That's how it should sound. And the best way to sound like that is to dictate your book instead of typing it out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's four really good pieces of advice there. So know what the end goal is with your book. Know where you want it to go once you've got it out there. Plan meticulously so you know exactly what you're saying at every stage of the thing. Dictate it to keep your voice. And just get on and do it as quickly as possible.
I would say the first draft you need to get out within a couple of weeks.
Okay.
I call them reconnaissance missions. I like getting a book out, then do a reconnaissance mission and go through it again. You can go over your book 6 or 7 times, but I would say that is better than, you know, I've seen people who've been writing their first chapter for 2 months. I'm just like, no, get the whole book out in 2 months and then you can go back to it and you can edit it. You can have beta readers who will give you ideas that you can implement into your book. It's much better just to get it out there and get other eyes looking at it, i.e. editors, beta readers, friends and family, than torturing yourself and writing just one chapter and trying to get it as perfect as possible before you move on to the second chapter.
That's really, yeah, really good advice. Yeah, yeah. And beta readers, I would not, the words go off my head because the dogs are disrupting I wouldn't stress enough how important it is to have beta readers who you trust to come back with some honest critical opinion. You don't want your who's going to say, "Oh yes, it's lovely, dear." You know, you want someone who's honest about it.
It's nerve-wracking, but I always say this to my students: would you rather a few beta readers come back and tell you that you've created a steaming pile of poo, or do you want 100 people on Amazon leaving you one-star reviews telling you that you've created a steaming pile of poo? And then they go, "Oh, I never thought of that. Actually, I will get some beta readers." So that, because I always get that. Every single student I've had is nervous to send it out to a beta reader. And I just say, "What would you prefer?" And then suddenly something clicks and they go, "Oh my God, I need to get real beta readers." So it's not good enough just to have family and friends who are going to just tell you you're amazing regardless. It's like, no, because if you hire those people, then you're not getting the feedback that you need. For me personally, having beta readers has been amazing. It actually, my book wouldn't even be called what it is if it wasn't for a beta reader. I was actually going to call my book Booked. Yes, I was being very clever, Alison. I was doing a pun on words there. I was too clever for, you know, too clever for school, really, wasn't I? I was going on this idea of, you know, people usually spend so much time generating leads and closing sales. And imagine how nice it would be if you could open your diary on a Monday morning and you're booked, you know, because you have this huge visibility and people come to you and want to work with you. I thought I was so clever. And then I sent it out to my beta readers, and two of my beta readers came back and said, "Look, we work in this industry. We work with entrepreneurs, coaches, consultants, experts. They don't want to be booked. They want to work less hours but make more money. They don't want to be booked from Monday to Friday. That's no life for them." And I was like, "Oh my God." And that was the title of my book. One of my beta readers came up with the word freedom and said, what people are really looking for when they go off and they create their new business, whatever their business is in, they're looking for freedom from something. Either looking for freedom from a terrible boss, or they're wanting freedom from doing the 40 to 50 hours work week, or they're wanting the freedom to be able to work at any location in the world. But freedom is in there. And that's where the idea came about, the Freedom Master Plan. So my book wouldn't even be called what it's called if it wasn't for a beta reader. So they're so important. They're so important to, I would say 10 beta readers, because then you will get 3 to 5 of them that will give you feedback in time. Because you know what people are like, you know, they have the best will in the world, but then life gets in the way and then they can't, they can't do it. So I would say pick 10 people within your industry, you know, not just friends and family, but within your industry, people who would be interested in that book anyway.
Yeah, your target reader really is what you want, isn't it? Your target reader. Yeah, I mean, I had a kind of similar-ish experience. My book is about raising a child with special needs, and I gave it to mostly parents of children with special needs, because that's who I wanted to read it. And two people came back and said, it's really good. We really like it, but we'd really love to hear what your daughter thinks of things or what your son thinks of things. I thought, that's an interesting idea. Well, how can I do that? And then I actually sat down and I interviewed my kids about what life had been like for them, and added two extra chapters to the book. And a lot of the Amazon reviews now say it was really lovely to hear from her son about,
And but you wouldn't have thought of that otherwise.
Doing that. No,
never thought. It's like with me, I never would even thought. I just thought surely that's what people want. That, you know, they're scrabbling for leads and they're scrabbling for sales. And surely they want a diary that's full of lovely clients. And then there was only my beta readers to come back and say, no, that's not what they're looking for. You know, they do want to be booked, but not booked solid, you know. And that idea of booked, calling your book booked, makes people think that they're going to be just bewildered with all these clients. That's not what they want. And it's amazing. I think beta readers are just, you have to have them. I wouldn't let any of my students even think of publishing a book without it being seen by beta readers first.
artist.
No, yeah, very true. Yeah, you mentioned publishing. So how do you go about publishing? Which in this multi platform world, yes, what's your publishing platform of choice?
We always use Amazon. I know there's some people will be like, "Boo, hiss, Amazon, you know, big monster." There is issues there. There's issues in any industry when one has such a massive monopoly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been told that even if you add up every other platform out there on the planet, they still only make up around about 30% of all the books sold in the world. So when you have Amazon, that is, it's not just a leader, it's just so, it's a Goliath, it really is.
Yeah.
You can almost understand, and they do things wrong. But when it comes to books, I have to say, they're really, really good at what they do. My experience with KDP and their team has been fantastic, especially with my book. I remember there was an issue. So for some reason, because my book is called The Freedom Master Plan. Master Plan is two separate words.
Yeah. Okay.
And I didn't realize in the US, master plan is two separate words. But in the UK, master plan is one word. Mm-hmm. And because I'm so used to writing in US English, because a lot of my copywriting clients were based in the US, that's why I did it. So then I realized that if somebody was just searching for the Freedom master plan, two separate words in amazon.co.uk, my book wasn't coming up. So I contact them straight away and they just handled it within 24 hours. Sorted everything out. Every problem I had, they just sorted out straight away. So they're very good with authors. Mm-hmm. So my platform of choice is Amazon, purely because of reach.
Yeah.
Also, I'm a big advocate for self-publishing, especially these kinds of books. I don't like bad-mouthing traditional publishers because there's a lot of really, really good traditional publishers out there. Really, really good ones. Yeah. But I tend to find that with a traditional publisher, they're basically coughing up the cost of the editor, the publishing, the graphic design. And the reason why they're doing that is they want to get a return on investment. That's their business. The thing is, we've already discussed just, you know, half an hour or so ago, that in this industry, the book itself is not the business. It's not about how many units you sell of the book. It's the visibility the book gets you. And I would worry with a traditional publisher, you know, a year or 2 years down the line into your contract, their ideas for the book verge away from what you want from the book, and you have different ideas. And, you know, you might be asked to speak at this amazing event, and you know, it's such a huge opportunity for you. And you know, the people in the audience are your absolute target market, and you want to gift them your book. You know, you want to give it to them. Maybe you put it into one of those web, you know, those goodie bags that you get, mm-hmm. you know, when you go to some seminars, and your publisher can easily just go, "No, we're not doing that."
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do that. And they ultimately own your book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get
you
paid.
You do
royalties.
Lose a lot of control, don't you? You lose a lot
exactly.
of control when you
Which
have
is absolutely fine if you're a fiction writer, because then the book is the business. So, you know, a traditional mm-hmm. publisher has some clout. But when it comes to writing these how-to business books, which are essentially going to be your business card, you know,
yeah,
you want to have complete control. If you want to give it away, you should be able to give it away. You should be able to charge the moon on a stick if you wanted. You want to be able to do whatever you want. You want to, if you want to create, I have some past students who have created special versions of their book for mm-hmm. specific people. So they've gone to a specific event and they created a specific version of their book just for that event or for a joint venture that they're working on. You'd have to get all of that signed off by a publisher.
Yeah,
and they probably and they may even say no, because if it doesn't suit their interest, then they're going to say no. So I always, you know, self-publishing is a way forward for me, because it means that I and my students have complete control over what we want our book to do for us. We don't see the book as the money spinner. The book is a tool, in the same way the website is a tool. Your social media profiles are a tool. You wouldn't like it if somebody owned your website. You'd be like, "Oh my God, no, it's my website. I want to be able to do whatever I want to do with my website."
Yeah,
if I want to change it all over again in 6 months' time, I should have the right to be able to do that. And that's, you have to have that with these books, and you won't get that with a traditional publisher.
Yeah.
So
the
only option is self-publishing.
Yeah. And you're right. Amazon, for all their faults, when it comes to self-publishing, Amazon are actually really good. It's a really easy system to use. You can change the price, you can change the content, you can change the cover, you can, yeah, you have full control. You can see your sales pretty much in real time, and it's just, yeah, a really easy system to use. So
it is, is. I would recommend. I'm considering uploading my book and my students' books into Ingram Spark to get that wider reach, because they kind of will do all the other major platforms. But like I said, you know, I've managed to hit bestseller status without needing to be, because Amazon is so ginormous, you know, so you can almost get away with just using Amazon and not bothering. But a part of me feels bad. A part of me feels like I should help all these other platforms. So I think I know the feeling.
Yeah. I know the feeling. But yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want their book in the world's biggest bookshop? It's kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've just looked at the clock and seen how long we've been talking for. The time has just flown. But before we go, I'd really like to know what have you learned about yourself through writing your book, and what has changed for you as a result of publishing it?
Oh gosh, Alison, I would say that writing a book, I mean, these books are not, then I don't do autobiographies. Okay. So I'm not, my book isn't an autobiography, and my students' books, none of them write autobiographies. I don't have any experience of that, so I'd feel like a con woman if I advertise myself as a book coach who can help you write your autobiography. I don't have experience of it. However, like I said, you know, a few minutes ago, these books, although they are full of knowledge and expertise and tips, that's what they should be, but there's also part of you in them, and that's why they need to be conversational in tone, because people do business with people they like. So you've got to give people the opportunity to like you. And what I mean by that is you write these books where I would say there's 70 to 80% tips, strategies, tactics, helping these people, you know, create a specific result that they want. Mm-hmm. But interspersed with that, you put in a little bit of yourself into it so they can see that this is a real person behind this business. And doing that, it brings up a lot. So for me, I ended up admitting things I'd never really admitted publicly, such as, you know, I did have a rough time for a couple of years in Manchester when I first moved over there to do my degree. I ended up dropping out of university because I became addicted to amphetamines. And it's something that I'd never really spoke to people about, but something about writing the book made me feel like I should be more honest about the struggles that I've had in the past. My book is dedicated to consultants and coaches and therapists, and because I wouldn't be where I am without those amazing people.
Yeah.
So, and I've noticed that with my students as well. It opens up a can of worms sometimes, you know, things that they buried in their past, and suddenly comes back and like, oh gosh. But it makes for a better book when you can be brutally honest. Yeah. And people can see what you've been through. So how has it changed me? I think it's made me far more honest. I didn't realize I was being so dishonest. But I realize now that I was creating, I think as a copywriter and a ghostwriter, I created this perfect facade of, I'm this amazing writer. Come to me with all your writing needs and I will help you. And writing this book and becoming a book coach and a book publisher has made me actually say, hey, I'm actually not perfect. And I've been through some hair-raising things in the past, but they've made me who I am. So, yeah, I think it has fundamentally changed me. It's made me a much more honest person. I'm much more willing to now talk about my past and what I went through.
Yeah, I think that, in whatever kind of book you're writing, I think being able to be honest, to open up and to be vulnerable, to make yourself vulnerable, actually makes you much more human, much more likable and much more relatable, because you're basically saying, look, I'm not perfect. I'm a wonderfully flawed human being like everybody else out there, but this is what I've done with my life. This is what I've achieved. And this is why I want you to listen to me. And other people can then grasp onto that rather than you saying, I'm amazing. You know, I'm this incredible person and you must listen to me. Well, why? You know, you don't live my life. You don't know what real life is like by the sounds of it. So being vulnerable is a very difficult thing to do, but a very important thing to do as well.
I wish I can go back and speak to my younger self now and just say, you know, you actually find more people gravitate towards you when you start being honest and being vulnerable. You know, you kind of think it's, when you're younger, you kind of think it's the opposite. You kind of think, well, people can't, what's that old saying? Laugh and the world laughs with you, cry and you cry alone. I think I really live my life by that saying. So I always was there, you know, wanting to make people happy, the good times. And I didn't want people to know about things that wouldn't make them laugh or wouldn't make them smile. But it's now that I'm realizing that more people gravitate towards me because I'm being honest about the struggles that I've been through. So, yeah, I hope more people can do that. It's quite liberating. You kind of have this huge burden all your life and thinking, oh, I shouldn't really talk about certain things. And then the reality is people like you even more for talking about those things. And you sat there thinking, why did I keep it hidden for so long? It was just so silly.
That's a really nice note to end on, I think. Yeah, the power of vulnerability, I think. I'm sure there's a book about that. Is it Brené Brown? Yeah.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
Mitali, it's been an absolute privilege to talk to you today. I've really enjoyed this. Where can people find you online if they want to find out more about you and your coaching and your book and everything that you do?
Well, they can go to my website. So it's called thefreedommasterplan.com. So that's thefreedommasterplan.com. On there you can actually get a sample chapter, so if you want to download a free sample chapter of the Freedom Master Plan, or you can just go straight to Amazon and get the book. There's also I'm going to give a gift. I just decided I'm going to give a gift.
Thank
I wasn't
you.
Even thinking
Thank
about
you
it
very much.
But yeah, if you go to thefreedommasterplan.com and then /5 steps, mm-hmm. So 5 as in spelt out, F-I-V-E steps, all one word, 5 steps, I've got a PDF guide that goes through the 5 steps of writing and publishing a business book. So it literally lays it out for you. So you can just go through it step by step, do it all yourself, or hire different people at different points to do different jobs for you. But you'll have a blueprint on how to go about planning, writing and publishing a business book.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for that. I'm sure people will go and download that. Mitali, thank you. It's been lovely.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Mitali for being my guest on the show today. You can find out more about her on her website, which is thefreedommasterplan.com, or you can buy her book, The Freedom Master Plan, on Amazon. Just search for the book title or for her name, which is Mitali Depakesa. I'll spell that for you. Mitali is M-I-T-A-L-I and Depakesa is D-E-Y-P-U-R-K-A-Y-S-T-H-A. You can find out more about me and the services I offer authors on my website, www.theproofairy.com. You'll also find all the episodes of this podcast there, along with information on how you could be a guest on the show. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please subscribe, share it, rate it, tell your friends about it, and review it. This has been a Proof Fairy production in collaboration with a very chatty pair of dogs today. And I'll be back next week with another inspiring interview with another amazing author.